phone right now, so I just want to get this all recorded. And Petros Vamvakas is in studio as well as Nicoleta Papadoyani. So let me just double check and make sure that I do have on the phone both Elizabeth and Aleko. Good morning. Kalimera sas.
Good morning.
Good morning. Alithos Anesti. How you guys doing?
We're doing all right. How about you?
Good. Let me. I'm just trying to get all these levels as clean as I can for the signal. Can I get a test from you guys?
Test.
Sure.
Elizabeth?
Okay,
Elizabeth. Okay. We can hear you a little muffled, but I think it's not too bad. Good morning, Kalimera sas.
Is this better now?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is.
Teddy, this is Aleko. How am I coming through for you?
Crystal clear, Aleko, as always.
And Petro and Nicoleta are there with you as well?
Yeah. Yes. We're ready.
Kalimera sas.
Kalimera sas.
Ευχαριστούμε πολύ.
Καλημέρα.
Που αφιερώνετε το Κυριακάτικο πρωινό σας να είστε στη συντροφιά τη δικιά μας και του φυσικά του ελληνισμού ολόκληρου εδώ της Νέας Αγγλίας.
Ευχαριστούμε πάρα πολύ. Μεγάλη τιμή μας. Χαρά μας.
All right, so listen, let's get right to it. There has been an awful lot going around, along, you know, Israel, Palestine, Gaza Strip. I wanted to get this started off, you know, a learning session as well, because, you know, we hear Israel, we hear Gaza Strip, and, you know, we're trying to bring some real awareness to our listening audience about, you know, the details of it. And who better than you guys? And Petro suggested this, so I want to thank Petro as well, because you two certainly are experts on that subject and that region.
Thank you. And I think we can start out probably with Petro, right? Because Petro, you had a fantastic guest speaker at your Institute on Mediterranean Studies on Thursday, Rami Khoury.
Yeah, we had thank you, Elizabeth. We had the first of a two-part discussion on Thursday with Rami Khoury, who's a renowned journalist and a non-resident fellow at the Kennedy School. And then on this Thursday, we're going to have the Consul General of Israel follow up at 12:30, sort of like, you know, just balance off the conversation as much as possible. But I think, you know, just to briefly talk about this, I think it's a very complex issue. It's not an issue of just black and white and good Palestinians, bad Israelis, or the other way around. I think it has a lot of dimensions that are political dimensions inside both the Palestinian Authority and within Israel itself. And if you followed the news the last 48 hours in Israel, you know, they're gearing up, sort of like, you know, they have to form a government by June 2nd. So there's, you know, issues there, and especially the personality of Bibi Netanyahu. And there's, of course, you know, all kinds of issues as far as geopolitical structures in Iran and Saudi Arabia and the U.S. But, you know, also the religious issue. And, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted Elizabeth and Aleko to be with us is that, you know, something that we don't necessarily pay a lot of attention to is that religious component and the geopolitics of religion right now.
Petro, there's not a thing you've said that I know both Elizabeth and I wouldn't concur with completely. Where does one begin in response to this? First, I think it's very useful to point out that what's often and characteristically narrated as an intractable, centuries-old conflict is neither intractable nor centuries-old. It's historically recent. Although we see it in ever-changing contours and incarnations. Today's crisis of the last couple or few weeks, let's say, is obviously historically rooted and politically complicated. But you mentioned the personality of Netanyahu as central to the equation, and he certainly is, and his interests are vital to understanding the sparking of the current crisis, which, in my view, is to a considerable extent a manufactured crisis. Now, like most crises that are manufactured, once they're unleashed, they take on unanticipated dimensions and add new layers of complication to an existing problem. I'm going to defer to the two political scientists here, you, Petro, and Elizabeth, to talk about those things, and I'll be happy to contribute a few points there, but I thought it might be useful to begin with that observation.
Yeah.
Cool. I'll jump in, and I think, you know, it's important for us to sort of understand the chain of events that led to the most recent round of violence. But I do think, you know, there's a short history, which you point out, a more immediate history, and some might date that from 1948 and the establishment of the State of Israel. Others might, and Rami Khoury was very emphatic about this, you know, going back to the late 19th century, mid-late 19th century, when we see the origins of the modern Zionist movement and the changing demographics on the ground that occurred as there was a movement of Jews from outside what's contemporary Israel into the territorial space where Palestinians were living, and that then came to be known as Mandate Palestine. But whether or not you take a long historical view or a shorter historical view, the proximate cause of the recent round of violence, I think, were, you know, two or three very specific episodes. The first was related to the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. And as most people know, during that month, there's day-long fasting and then breaking of the fast in the evening. And during that period, security barriers had been set up around the Damascus Gate, which is one of the main entrances into the city of the old city of Jerusalem. And as is oftentimes the case at that entrance during Ramadan, there's a lot of family gathering and picnicking, and sometimes there are episodic violence. But in this case, the gate had been shut down, or barriers had been set up. That created, the beginnings of rising tension and some episodes in and around the old city related to the inability of fasting Muslims during Ramadan to gather with their families in the evening. At the same time as that was happening, we began to see the active presence of far religious right, and in many cases demographically between the ages of 18 and 30, younger Israeli Jews who have a maximalist policy about Jerusalem, certainly, but about Israel more generally. And there were episodes of tension between those groups that would, go around the outside of the city and inside the old city and shout anti-Palestinian slogans. So tensions were rising already during the latter period of the month of Ramadan. And then an order was issued. Well, it had been issued already, but there was an ongoing Israeli police presence in a neighborhood in the old city of Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah, about the eviction of a set of Palestinian families from there, and those homes were going to be demolished. So tensions were rising already before the outbreak of the violence, which was caused over an incident or incidents on the Dome of the Rock, which is what Muslims call the place where the mosque is in Jerusalem, or the Temple Mount, which is what Jews call the location of their holiest shrine. So this is the kind of lead up to what then escalated into full blown violence between Gaza and Israel. So I think it's important to, emphasize this fact that tensions are always simmering, to put it in the vernacular, and, small or large things can set off the kind of full-scale wholesale violence that then we saw for several days between Israel and Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, I just to follow up on both of those points, I think, just to go back to Aleko's point, I think that the central to this is Netanyahu and the artificiality of this violence. But I also, the points that Elizabeth just made, there has to be a distinction between what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah and the eviction and the action after May 10th, which is the bombing of Gaza. And I would go further than that and say separate also the level of response and what we saw the next 11 days. Because you have sort of layers of different things taking place. And one of the things that's really disturbing is the fact that how much politically motivated the bombing of Gaza was, that there was already a flicker of justification for doing what Israel did as an organized state in response to rockets fired from Gaza in response to what happened at Al-Aqsa Mosque. However, the level by which Israel responded and what they did in the last 11 days, the level of destruction inside Gaza, I think it's also politically motivated, and it has all kinds of other dimensions that are that should be worrying to everybody. And what I say politically motivated is on May 10th, there was a coalition government in place to replace Mr. Netanyahu, the longest serving prime minister of Israel after 12 years. Here's a man who has been indicted and is a man who's facing possible jail time. And for many, the fact that this campaign begins, it sort of like freezes the entire process. And Israel has a process of election just like we do in Greece. So there's an order by the second party to form a government by June 2nd. So that clock is ticking. So Mr. Netanyahu, you know, pulled the trigger, I think, on an event that tried to forestall his stay in power. We'll wait and see how well that was received within Israel. And his opposition, ironically, is coming from his right, not necessarily from his left. So Israeli politics is very much in the forefront of this. And I think what we have seen in Gaza has to be separated and has to be viewed as some kind of, like, you know, outside of the realm of even international law, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah, and Petra, I think, you know, you're referencing the politics of Israel as well as the politics of the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinian territories, is really important because that's, you know, there's a context in which this latest round of violence is happening. And, you know, we know that in Israel there have been multiple rounds of elections over the last 2.5 years without any success in forming a government. So if indeed many experts anticipate there's going to be another national election in Israel this year, that would be the fifth election, national election in Israel since 2019, which speaks to the lack of legitimacy of the Israeli political class in the eyes of its own citizens, because it's impossible to end up forming a government. You know, some would argue that's a function of the, you know, the electoral system, the way, you know, for the process for forming a government. But more generally, most conclude that there's a gross lack of legitimacy in the political class, and I think, you know, the poster child for that is Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu. And then on the other side, you know, most recently, Mohammed Abbas, Abbas postponed elections in the Palestinian territories in the West Bank indefinitely. He said that because Palestinians in Jerusalem were not going to be allowed to vote in the elections, he would postpone the elections. But again, the bottom line is that there's a growing lack of legitimacy amongst Palestinians for their own elected leaders, whether it's the Palestinian Authority or whether it's Hamas. But I think the most important point for us to emphasize, as you did, is the grossly disproportionate use of force against the Palestinians. And some of the numbers that we've been seeing, and I think they're worth mentioning, are that, you know, there were 227 people killed in Gaza, including 64 children. Over 1,000 homes were destroyed. Up to 75,000 people were internally displaced. That is, their residents were destroyed, so they now have nowhere to live. Hospitals, schools, media towers were all destroyed. So all of the basic infrastructure, as well as residences that were destroyed over the past week, leave a sense of despair in terms of how to move things forward, in terms of what everyone keeps talking about, a renewal of the peace process.
Yeah. If I could defer to Aleko, and we had a conversation during the week about the size and shape of the Gaza Strip. And Petro actually drew something out, and then Aleko even brought us. So can we kind of, for the listening audience, you know, they hear Gaza Strip, they don't know really, you know, where it is or what it is, but give us the size and shape of it and draw the analogy, if you could, Aleko.
Sure, I'm happy to, Teddy. The Gaza Strip is literally a strip of land, essentially a sand strip along the coast of the eastern Mediterranean, sandwiched between Israeli territory and Egypt. It is a space that is territorially tiny. It is equivalent, more or less, to the outer part of the Cape. So if you can imagine the area from, let's say, the Chatham line to Provincetown, that constitutes the whole of Gaza. And it's similar. It is a very narrow strip of land surrounded by the sea on one side, which is closed to the people of Gaza under essentially an Israeli naval blockade, and that's also closed by another blockade enforced along its lengthiest border with Israel. And its border to Egypt is also closed and highly regulated. It is, in other words, an isolated islet of land, deliberately blockaded and isolated from the outside world. Now, again, if we can imagine the Outer Cape, where year-round there are approximately 20,000 residents, Gaza, of equal size, comparable shape, has a essentially captive population of approximately 2.1 million people.
I'm having a hard time, you know. It's you know, the only thing I can equate that to is a can of sardines. That's it.
Well, that's not an invalid comparison, Teddy. That's a pretty accurate view of things. Yes, it's an area that's horribly, densely populated, but what makes those conditions worse for the people of Gaza is that they really have no control over the conditions under which they live. Things as basic and ordinary as access to water, access to energy, access to electricity, those things are completely controlled by the Israeli authorities, which of course claim to no longer be in occupation of Gaza, but in operational and de facto terms continue to occupy Gaza through this kind of indirect regime of control, through isolation. Access to food, access to medical supplies, access to educational resources, those things fundamental and vital to everyday life are things that are controlled by the outside, de facto occupying power, Israel. Israel no longer has troops on the ground in Gaza precisely because it does not need to. And Israeli artillery batteries, Israeli aerial forces, Israeli rocket forces are the equivalent of an occupation force of distance. But again, more importantly, the everyday access to necessary resources and management of life in Gaza is in the hands of the Israeli authorities. So compounded with, again, if we can imagine the Outer Cape with 100 times the number of people that live there today, not being able to leave the Cape, and then we compound that with an outside power of occupation that controls their access to electricity, to medicine, to everything that we consider crucial to modern life. That's the condition that the people of Gaza are facing.
Including constant surveillance.
Constant surveillance.
Drones constantly flying over.
You know, that is so hard to envision, just to live under those circumstances. This is, you know, this is today. And here we are, you know, if there's anything that COVID has taught me here, you know, we're in our own little New England, and Otinapis, you know, we've got the finest hospitals. We didn't experience anything in regards to, well, what could have been a really bad situation across, and I can't even imagine what the Gaza Strip was like during COVID.
All right, let me even make it even more personal, more immediate. We were in the studio, and the AC was off for a little bit, and we, the three of us, were like, you know, really, there's electricity for possibly like 6 hours a day mm-hmm. on a good time. Now they might have electricity 3 hours a day. Because of the infrastructure damage, 80% of the water supply has been damaged by the bombings. So,
and that's 80. And Petro, that's 80% of a water supply that healthcare officials estimate. 96% of household water in Gaza is already not.
So, is like the Red Cross out there and everybody full house? What's going on in regards to the relief effort?
Well, yeah, We tend to equate the Gaza Strip with Hamas, and we're missing out the point that both Aleko and Elizabeth just made. They're human beings there
right.
with their families,
right.
with the right to access of water, electricity, jobs,
human rights.
You know, and just the basic access and the ability to move.
And it's really important to consider how the international community respond to the conflict and how they react. And yes, we're having this conversation today, but I haven't heard a lot about
how this conflict started, what it happened during all these years.
Well, so Nicoletta raises a very important point here, and it's a dimension that, yes, I think has been underreported, certainly in the American media. And I want to link the beginning of that discussion to the point that all of you have been talking about, which is the humanitarian and crisis, humanitarian dimensions and crisis of the recent 11-day-long spate of fighting. Let's begin with the most important foreign actor vis-a-vis Israel-Palestine, Israel-Gaza, and that, of course, is the United States. The current chief executive, President Biden, made it clear on Thursday that he was committed to bringing humanitarian relief to the region. However, at the same time that he offered condolences for the loss of Palestinian life and committed to provide humanitarian aid that would flow quickly to the region, he specified that it would flow only to the Palestinian Authority, which has control only over the West Bank, nominal control in the West Bank, but not Gaza. In fact, he was clear, and I have a quote here. President Biden stated, quote, "We will do this in full partnership with the Palestinian Authority, not Hamas, and in a manner that does not permit Hamas to simply restock its military arsenal." Now, this is a common narrative that American presidents, current and all preceding presidents, have made whenever a crisis has taken place in Gaza, and that is that humanitarian aid will be provided, but it will not be provided to the victims of the humanitarian crisis. Instead, it will go to the Palestinian Authority. Why? We deliberately distort humanitarian aid with military aid. But at the same time, President Biden, in one of his six conversations with Netanyahu during the crisis, assured Netanyahu that the United States would quickly restock the Israel's missile defense system and replenish its artillery munitions to the exact number of shells that were expended in the shelling and bombarding of Gaza. This speaks to a very problematic approach to the crisis in Gaza, because every time an Israeli attack has been launched against Gaza, and you can argue as to whether these attacks have been justified militarily, I hold to a certain view, but the fact of the matter is that there is very little in the way of international humanitarian aid coming from the United States, the chief actor, that helps to restore the conditions in Gaza physically and in every other respect.
Yeah, on that same point about the United States, and that has been part of the conversation over the last 2 weeks, whether or not, and certainly preceding that, but intensified, whether or not the United States can, you know, claim to or is recognized to be an honest broker in trying to help resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I think one event in the last several years, more than others, reinforced the view that that's not possible. And Petro, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Rami Khoury, you know, was quite explicit about the fact that neither Israelis nor Palestinians any longer recognize the U.S. as a neutral, honest broker. And the event that I'm mentioning is the December 2017 decision by President Trump to formally recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and he moved the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Now, you know, that's something that the United States had the right to do, to move its embassy, but, you know, it had refrained from doing that for the last several decades precisely because it understood that such a move would support the claims of the Israeli government that Jerusalem is a single unified capital of the State of Israel, as opposed to the Palestinians' claim that Jerusalem should be under some formula managed by both Israel and Palestine, with half of Jerusalem under as the capital of Israel, half as the capital of Palestine. So the U.S. has been constantly undermining its own position for playing a constructive role in the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And just to footnote on Aleko's point, Hamas launched over 4,000 rockets into Israel over the past 11 days. 12 12 Israelis were killed. I read you the numbers on the Palestinian side, you know, exponentially larger. But that speaks to also the fact that 4,000 rockets launched with Israel's Iron Dome air defense system. They enjoy the protection of that system. And that's why you have even, you know, former Israeli Defense Force officials writing in the last, 11 days about the disproportionality in terms of the use of force between Israel and Gaza.
And to the point of America's position, as it would like to and often does refer to itself as a neutral, honest broker in the this and preceding crises, I think it's important to be very careful and de-pack the emergent media narrative that presents the United States and specifically the White House as the chief broker in the current ceasefire. There's no evidence to suggest that that's the case. There's considerable evidence to the contrary. In fact, President Biden, before the ceasefire went into place, acknowledged that Egypt had played the most crucial role in brokering the ceasefire, as it has in the past under during similar crises. But once the ceasefire was in place, the American media, by and large, jumped to asserting that it was the United States that was the chief actor in resolving the fighting. And the White House itself, including President Biden himself, was quick to piggyback onto this argument. Then, after the fact, claiming what he described as quiet, relentless diplomacy for having produced the ceasefire. It was Egypt that produced the ceasefire, not the United States. In fact, during the crisis, as Egypt was quietly brokering the ceasefire, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki continually emphasized Israel's right to defend itself and continually emphasized that there would be a ceasefire, but only once Israel had achieved its military objectives, something that Netanyahu himself reiterated.
Guys, can we just, and I don't think it plays much of a role at all, but, you know, does Greece play into this at all, into this equation at all?
Greece could, but Greece doesn't. I mean, Greece could, and we saw Mr. Dendias go there for, towards the tail end last week and at the Patriarchate, and also, visited both the Palestinian Authority, Abu Abbas, in Ramallah, and also with the Israelis. And Greece could, if Greece wanted to, and, because of the Patriarchate, because the foothold there. But to the point that that Aleko was just making, and I just want to just add to all of it, I think more and more my biggest fear is that the United States is becoming irrelevant in the region, and this is just another one of those cases where we had a president of the United States come out and initially just repeat what American presidents have been saying since the 1970s, namely that Israel has the right to defend itself. Okay. And then you had the Israeli leadership say, we are going to do this as long as we want to and as long as we think so, and conquering is an option, and we're going to take action the way that we want to. I think in many ways the U.S. since 2011 has pivoted psychologically out of the area. We have pivoted out of, physically now out of Afghanistan, and everybody's seeing this. And In some measure, some geopolitical measure, what we are seeing in Israel the last 11 days is a world without the United States really having the ability to whip allies and enemies into place. And I think that is sort of like a big picture fear for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Petro raised an interesting point of view, one that I concur with, which is that Greece can play a vital role. Obviously, Greece is a small country. It has a limited capacity to project power or influence in the region. Its chief preoccupation is preserving the status quo and its own national defense vis-a-vis a very aggressive and revisionist power to the east, Turkey. But Greece is also in a very unique position culturally and historically, in that the Greeks, more than any other, if you will, European people, have a very long history, the longest history of cultural interaction, connection, and familiarity and presence that's non-colonial and non-imperial in the region. Today, Greece has a very close relationship, a partnership, in effect, with Egypt. The Greeks have a very close relationship with the Arab world writ large in the Near East. Greece was one of the few European powers that, that did not assume a belligerent attitude towards the multiple actors in Syria during the Syrian civil war. And through the structures of orthodoxy, Greece has a vital presence in the region that no other party can rival. Of course, in order for Greece to project itself into the region in a constructive way, it can only do so in partnership with great powers, the United States, France, etc. But since those great powers are reluctant to use Greece in that kind of constructive way because of their own parochial engagement with the region, Greece hasn't been given the opportunity to do for the West what I think it could do to contribute to conflict resolution in the region.
Following up, Aleko, following up on your point and Petro's point as well, I think, you know, Greece is uniquely positioned in many ways, and not only because, as you said, of its historic presence in the region, but non-colonial presence and history of interaction in the region with the Palestinians, but also more recently because of the incredibly constructive energy partnership that also includes Israel. So Greece is in a position to talk to both Israelis and Palestinian leaderships, and I think, as you said, I mean, it can be enabled and should take its own initiative to do so. Teddy, can I just for your listeners as well, in addition to the question about Greece, I think it's important for us to recognize as well that there's a Palestinian Christian presence that's oftentimes overlooked in this discussion. And Christians are indigenous, of course, to the region and to the Holy Land. After all, we're talking about cities like Jerusalem and Bethlehem. I mean, these are the cities that we just celebrated, right, with Pascha. And yet they're largely overlooked in a narrative that presents the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a Jewish-Muslim conflict. And I think it's very important to recognize that, you know, this is the taproot of the three Abrahamic traditions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, when we're talking about Israel and Palestine. And indeed, the heads of churches, including the Greek Orthodox Patriarchate of Jerusalem, and he is the presiding officer of the heads of churches in the Holy Land, they did issue a categorical statement calling on all sides to stop the violence. And I think it's important to recognize that Christian institutions are also playing a vital role, as they have all along. But now you asked about relief and relief efforts. So particularly in terms of hospitals, the Anglican Archbishop of Jerusalem, Archbishop Hossam Naum, he made a plea for, fuel needs for generators to keep hospitals running. Christian organizations, relief organizations, are working with international organizations to try to help deliver COVID-19 vaccines, because we're seeing a skyrocketing in COVID cases simultaneous now with the violence. And we're talking about the Palestinian territory in Gaza, where the West Bank and Gaza, where vaccinations have been, I think something like 2% of the population has been able to be vaccinated.
To this point.
So it's important to recognize that when we talk about Palestinians and when we talk about citizens of Israel, we also should include the Christian population, and that's a tiny, tiny population left at now, maybe 6% in Israel and 2% in the Palestinian territories. And they are at risk of, they're certainly squeezed out of the narrative, but despite the fact that they play such a vital role in education and healthcare, et cetera, in the Holy Land, they're oftentimes completely excluded from peace processes, much less from the narrative about what's happening on the ground. And in that regard, they're collateral damage of the broader conflict.
Yeah, very well said.
And just as a footnote, Teddy, just for the listeners, in Gaza itself, again, in this population of more than 2 million people, underscoring the erasure of Christianity in the region, there are today about 2,500 to 3,000 Christians in Gaza, indigenous Christians, all of whom, incidentally, are Greek Orthodox Christians.
Greek Orthodox, all of them. Guys, we're a little bit up against the clock here today since we spoke. We were actually delighted because we have a wedding to celebrate today, and it's the first wedding that we've had on Grecian Echo since COVID began celebrating. They had it last night. I think it was 100 people there, and they're sharing. So we're opening up again. You got, how are you guys? How'd you listen? We spoke, I think, several months back. When things were going on in Turkey. You guys are back and ready to go, vaccinated, we hope, or at least feel comfortable enough to get out there again?
Oh, absolutely, Teddy. We're vaccinated. We're still very cautious, though. Mm-hmm. And we continue to safeguard ourselves. We wear our mask when we go into the public square. We're very happy that things are improving, even if they're improving incrementally. Vaccinations should make a difference, according to everyone's view. And Elizabeth and I we're going to be teaching, at least I'll be teaching in person come the fall after having spent a year doing so remotely. Mm-hmm. So we're looking to some measure of normalcy returning to society.
Guys, I can't thank you so very much. And Sophia, is Sophia graduated or is she still at school?
Elizabeth, do you want to share the happy news?
Yeah. She just graduated on Friday from Trinity College. Yeah.
All right. I'm glad I brought that up. I knew that she was either. That's terrific. So that's it. That's it.
That's great. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Congratulations. Congratulations. Elizabeth Prodromou. Alexandros Kiros, thank you so very much, as always. Guys, I did record this, and I will create a podcast for those who might have missed it and put it on our websites. I'll send you a copy as well. But as always, thank you so much. Huge contribution always for us, and looking forward to seeing you face-to-face back in studio soon.
Thanks. Likewise. Thanks, Teddy. Teddy and Petro and Nicoletta, I mean, you're all aware of this, of course, but we're coming up against the anniversary of May 29th, so I don't know what you're, planning to talk about that day, but, I think it's important to remind people that it's the fall of Constantinople.
Maybe we can regroup then, and that way we hear it right. We'll talk. We'll talk. Okay. How's that?
I'd love to have you guys. Thanks to all three of you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Teddy.
Have a great day. Enjoy the sunshine. It's a beautiful day.
Bye-bye.
Nastikala. Bye-bye, everybody.
Καλημέρα να έχετε. Ευχαριστούμε.
Επίσης, yeah.